Donald in the Kitchen talks about food. Donald in the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio. Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Nartigal.
And I'm Donna Puskintas.
We gather here once a week to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we gather here around our kitchen table at KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames. Community Radio is a real good place to be. I'm glad you've joined us today. Well, although I don't think we're going to have frost for a bit, Donna, it sure seems frosty out there compared to what our summer has been. So I'm kind of putting the garden to bed, cleaning things up.
Well, I'm spending more time outside because some of the air this summer was, yeah, it was hot, but it was also like Canadian wildfires. And so now the air actually feels much better.
I hope so. Kind of crisp autumn-ish feeling.
Yeah, just like it's supposed to feel.
Yeah. And so I'm pulling up things in the garden and cleaning up a little bit and planning for next year. Where are we going to put this? Where are we going to put that? Already thinking about, well, we're going to probably be planting garlic for next year in a couple weeks. I've got to figure that out. See, it just really never ends, but that's part of the fun of having a garden. Well, besides that, it's kind of time to find those warm mittens and comfy sweaters. A little chilly. Yes, yes.
Oh, yeah. I've already gotten into the cedar chest and hauled out a few of my favorite sweaters, my winter uniform kind of thing, you know, where I wear the same sweater every day because it's so cozy.
Yeah, it makes a difference. You have to have a favorite. Yes, you do. Well,
we're going to go a little nuts today.
You mean more than usual, though.
A little more nuts, more than usual today.
This has been quite a year for tree fruit and nuts. We are going to talk about local nuts today, Doc.
Now, let's see. When we have a year like this, it's referred to as a heavy mast year.
Yeah, heavy mast.
I don't know where that word. So mast means nut fall. Does it just mean acorns? I have no idea.
Let me see.
I mean, most native tribes actually had a way to eat acorns, besides the walnut. The squirrels, of course, eat the acorns. But
well, I will be referring to this book throughout the show here, but I pulled it off the shelf. It's called The Hidden Life of Trees by Peter Wolenben. He is a researcher, and he's actually based in Great Britain, I think, but he kind of looks at trees all over the world. Here's what he has to say about mast, M-A-S-T.
Yes.
Mast years is an old term used to describe years when beeches and oaks set seed in great quantity. And that was a real boon for not only the human beings that ate that sort of thing, but for the wild boar and the domestic pigs that were fed on the mast, all the stuff that fell from oaks.
Oh, that's true. You know, Spain is particularly, you know, there's that Iberico ham, which is a little like our prosciutto, but it's very pricey and very coveted. And the reason it's supposed to be so good is because they run the pigs through the acorn forests in certain parts of Spain.
Right. And actually, some people are kind of doing that here. I don't know about running through
the forests. They are. I think in Appalachia, one of the, you know, since farmers had the loss of their tobacco crops, people have started reforesting and doing other agricultural alternatives. And one of them is running pigs through the forest to get those, you know, the nuts, the nut-fed pigs or something like that.
Well, see, nuts. And we like nuts, too. Today, on the Donna Lana Kitchen, we will take a look at local nuts. Uh-huh. And we'll take a look at homemade cider press, too. Because as we found out on our farm, there is more than one way to skin an apple. Yes, there is. There's different ways of doing cider. And my husband came up with kind of an interesting way of pressing cider. So, joining us today is Joe Lynch. He's a local farmer. He's a forager. He's Lana's husband for lo these many years. And
a very patient man.
And
yes,
a patient man. And we both live together on Onion Creek Farm. Welcome, Joe.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Good.
Right. I can't believe in 10 years this is the first time we've had Joe on air. So he's been consulted a lot.
Right.
Not insulted, but consulted.
Well, I've been on local talk, but yeah. I haven't been on here.
Yeah.
Very good.
So Joe and Lana, they have at least one, they have multiple fruit-bearing trees, but there's one really good Empire apple tree that every few years produces a lot. And this year was a good year.
Yeah, the apples were beautiful and precious little insect damage, really. Some, but not a lot.
Yeah,
we don't spray, so...
Yeah, as we found out, nuts have mast years where there's lots of stuff. Apples and other fruit comes and goes. It doesn't happen every year. This was a good year. And although, Joe, you go after walnuts on our farm and get nuts from other places, this is a pretty good year. Talk about how you gather walnuts and what other stuff you do with nuts.
Well, truth is, there's black walnuts all over town. If you really go looking for them, you'd be astonished how many you'd find. There are black walnuts on people's farmsteads and suburban lots. They're just everywhere. And people hate running over them with their lawnmower. That's always an issue.
You can stumble on them if there's enough of them.
You can stumble on them, absolutely. But I rake them up with a leaf rake. That works pretty well. And you have to put them somewhere, let them dry, so the husks
come down. But when they first fall, they're green, and they're almost golf ball size.
Well, they're bigger than that.
Yeah.
No, that with the husk on, they're bigger than that. It depends on the tree. Some trees produce bigger ones than others. But
well, I love the green walnut smell. Mm. I mean, okay, my grandmother lived in Walnut, Illinois, so we were a walnut-centric family. And something about that smell of the before they dry, it has nothing to do with how they are afterwards.
Right.
But the green shell on them has this almost citrusy thing. I just love to roll it in my hands and keep sniffing on it. But you have to get rid of that.
And people use that after it's dried down some. They use it, soak it in water, that husk, and use it as a dye. It produces a wonderful dye.
Oh, right. If you're picking black walnuts, you end up with black hands.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's nice. Nice way to dye things if you're into that.
Well, as a kid, we, of course, ate black walnuts. I did not love them so much as a child. It was definitely an acquired taste. But my mother used to refer to the kind of store-bought walnuts as English walnuts, which have a very different flavor from black walnuts.
Right. Not the same at all. Well, anyway, rake them up, take them and put them in 5-gallon buckets and take them home and throw them out on the driveway or somewhere where they'll dry down. That's actually the biggest problem with them. If you collect very many, I mean, we just collected 1,000 of them the other day.
We didn't count them.
We need a place to put them while they dry down.
Mm-hmm. How long does that usually take?
Oh, depends on how warm the place is. We put them in our greenhouse last year, but got in the way of doing laundry.
okay.
But it could take, several weeks to get them good and dry, and then you can rub the husk off with your foot, or you can do what some people do is soak it off and put them in water, but it makes a huge mess.
Reading on that, what's his name, the forager guy, forager chef? He was talking about he likes to just leave them, out in the driveway or someplace because certain beetles come and kind of go into it. They don't seem to bother the nut, but they eat the shell off so that when you drive your car over them.
Well, I was reading that this morning. What he said was actually, I didn't know this. There's a worm.
A worm, okay.
It's not a beetle, it's a worm.
Okay.
And it starts the fermenting process.
Of the shell.
Of the husk.
Yeah.
I call it husk.
Husk, right. Because the shell is a different, right. The shell is inside the husk.
Exactly.
Right. So first you got to get rid of the husk.
Right.
Okay.
And then let them get good and dry. And they do need to cure for a while. Because I cracked one open last night just to see. It was an early one. And the nut was still soft and it wasn't ready. And
so do you think a month is curing
probably
time?
Uh-huh. Maybe something like that.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember. I don't know actually how long it takes. I haven't tried to scope that out. I just left them until I got around to winter came. You know,
it's a wintertime project.
Yeah, exactly.
Picking the nuts. So
right.
And do you roll over them with the carb?
Well, that's one thing you can do. You just do it with your foot if it's dry.
And it doesn't crack the shell. It only cracks the husk.
Shell is super hard. I don't know. I've always amazed by squirrels that can eat a black walnut shell. They're unbelievably hard. I don't know how they do it, but they do it. The other thing that we're doing right now is my neighbor, well, I'll say it this way. There's a close relative to the black walnut, which is called the butternut.
They're relatives.
Well, they're the same family.
Huh.
They're very closely related.
Very different flavor, though.
But a very different flavor. But they're also called the white walnut. The wood is very different than black walnut wood. It's light colored and much lighter in weight, but it finishes up very nicely. But it's very rare, it's approaching rarity now because about 20 years ago, there's a butternut canker. It's a fungus that attacks butternut trees, and it's killed most of the native butternut trees. They used to be in the forests all over the Midwest and Wisconsin.
I have to say they're really good.
And they're pretty rare now because they've all died. But my industrious neighbor planted five or six of them like 10 years ago, and he's overwhelmed with butternuts.
Oh, good fortune.
Yeah, it is. And they're more torpedo shaped than round like a black walnut, but they're every bit as hard, and they have a similar nut, but the internal structure is different, so you crack them a different way.
Okay, do we also have hickory nuts around here?
Yes, we have hickory nuts. There are several different varieties. There's shagbark hickory. There's bitternut hickory. Bitternut is too bitter to eat, but the Native Americans made it, pressed it for oil, and the oil was very prized. The woman that wrote that book from Ireland that you know about trees.
Oh, what is her name?
Burford's Kellogg or Kroger.
Kroger is her last name.
She says the butternut, not the butternut, the bitternut hickory is the king of the forest in places where it still grows.
We
have a few in our backyard.
The bitternut ones?
Yeah.
Huh.
We don't have any shagbarks on our property. Uh-huh. We have a couple of bitternuts and some new bitternuts that have grown up from this tree. And there's one out by our garage, of all places. I don't know how it got there.
Well, I have several... I have a lot of acorns in my yard
for
the squirrels. And I have to say, many years ago when I was working with some California Indians, Karuk tribe, they actually showed me, because California produces a lot of, you know, it has different kinds of oak than we have here.
Right.
But in fact, they have some oaks that don't drop their leaves and things like that, but they produce the nuts, and it was a staple in the California Indian diets. And so they are bitter. They have lots and lots of tannins. But what the process, you know, in pre-industrial times was to crack the nuts enough to get the meats out and then to take the meats and put them in something, you know, a porous container and put them in the river.
Right.
And then the water washes and washes and washes
out
of the alkaline alkalize out or whatever, right, the bitterness out.
Right. And you then can go on YouTube and find out.
And then it's dried, right, and then ground into a flour.
Exactly.
Very, very nutritious.
It's a huge pain in the butt to do all that.
Well, yeah, but, you know, that was the lifestyle then. There were a lot of things they didn't have to do that we have to do now, so they
There's
had time
a huge
to
red oak right on the corner of the parking lot at Wheatsville Grocery, and it produces gargantuan amounts of
tons of nuts.
Of nuts.
Yeah.
We planted 30 years ago from a nursery out west a bur oak that's supposed to have sweet nuts.
Sweet acorns. The bur oak has sweet acorns?
Well, this particular variety does.
Because we have lots of bur oak around. It's become my favorite tree. I think they're so beautiful. The shapes of the limbs.
And some of them have been around for 200 years here.
Yeah. It's amazing that they're still in the savannas. Yeah.
Still around.
Uh-huh.
But bitter nuts, hickory nuts, if you want hickory nuts, find a shagbark hickory. And they're fairly easy to crack. And they're kind of hard to pick, but they're delicious. We, Lana and I, had in the past many years ago found an Amish family up in Wisconsin that collected and picked the hickory nuts.
Yeah.
And it was harder to find them. People who were willing to pick them, but you could find them and do them yourself, you know.
Well, so there's a farmer in Iowa, Cindy Madsen, who comes once a month to Ames, and you can buy pork and chickens and beef from them. But she's also got some neighbor who's picking black walnuts, and I usually buy from her because they are. Now, Joe likes to shell nuts. That's why we have him on the show today, because he's going to talk about. I can remember as a child, people used to always sit around the table and shell nuts.
Well, yeah, before Netflix, I think.
Yes, yes, before television. Right?
But for butternut or walnuts, you have to have a way to crack them.
Yeah.
And they're not easy to crack, you know.
Yeah, yeah, and those little pincher things that my mother used to, those are not good enough.
They won't do it.
I mean, you can maybe crack two or three, but after that, you're done.
If you have a decent-sized vise in your garage or basement, workshop, you can crack them but it has to be a pretty good size vise. A little one won't do it. That works. There's a number of crackers on the market that you can find on YouTube and other places.
Well, you just got a new one. What do you think?
Well, I haven't tuned it. I haven't practiced with it yet, but I think it's going to work really well.
It's your new winter toy.
It's made by some guy in a little town just next to Monticello, Iowa.
Eastern Iowa.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And it's called, his brand name is Overbuilt.
Overbuilt, okay.
It's pretty stout, okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like it's going to work great.
So it's big enough that you have to mount it on
something.
Yeah, something solid.
Right.
So then the idea is you let the walnuts dry till the hull comes off, right?
Right.
Okay, then you have the hulled walnuts, and then you crack a bunch of them with the cracker. Yeah.
The cracker.
And then you pick them.
Right, right.
It's quite a process.
Right.
So we were watching, Joe and I both watched this Alan Burgo, who does, we call him the Forager Chef, and he has a little YouTube about his nutcracker, which is called Grandpa's Goody Gitter. Which is another large mechanical, well, large, I don't know.
It's a desktop
tabletop
thing.
Yeah.
It works great. The only downside, it's not cheap. It costs almost $200.
Yeah, for the grandpa's
Goody
Gitter.
But it works really well. I'm quite convinced. And it's easy to use, which is the other good thing about it. And it's fast.
If you want to produce any kind of quantity, you need to like.
Now, I've seen, you'll laugh at this. I've seen a guy on YouTube, who used a shop vac and set up a 15-foot long tube and put the suction of the shop vac at the bottom of it and drops the walnuts down the tube, and the time it gets to the bottom, it hits a steel and it shatters.
No, it doesn't hit the shop vac. It hits what?
Well,
well, he set up something?
He set up some plate at the bottom. He's got it all figured out.
Oh!
He's got it all figured out how to do it, you know. And
so he's just dropping them in like golf balls,
right, exactly. I think the downside is often it doesn't crack them enough.
Oh.
And the pieces are too big to get the nut out.
Well, that was the thing in the video about the grandpa's goody getter.
Right.
And hopefully for your new tool, that it cracks them. Like he was, Chef Burgo was bragging that he actually was able to extract a whole
walnut. That's pretty amazing.
He said it doesn't happen very often.
Right.
But obviously, cracking it properly is the key to getting, because once you crack it, you still have to dig it out. So if it's properly cracked, the access is a lot easier because the downside of getting lots of little bitty pieces is you often get pieces of the shell into the mix with the nuts, which is, when you go to bake with them, it's really annoying.
Well, my solution to that, I think, works is I use a colander to sift them. To sift out the little pieces, and that gets almost all of them, you know.
So the big things stay on the top, and
exactly.
There was another method that he showed on another video, which I could not find this time. But he was using water, and apparently,
I hadn't seen that. In the
It wasn't on that video.
It may float them. That's a great idea. I haven't tried it.
Well, what I don't remember is, I suppose the walnuts sink to the bottom and the shells rise to the top or something. Because it's like if you're not really careful when you crack them, because I like to use black walnuts a lot. And culinary tip for black walnuts: if somebody says they don't like black walnuts, bake them in something chocolate. I have yet to see, because the two flavors, the chocolate and the black walnut, I've yet to see a person who didn't love, like, chocolate chip cookies with black walnuts. Or I often do my Christmas fudge with black walnuts. Sometimes black walnuts are too... Did you have this as a child in Missouri? It's called Divinity Fudge, but it's not.
Yeah.
It's not fudge. It's basically egg whites, and it always had black walnuts in it. Mm-hmm. Now they're a very strong flavor.
Right.
I mean, I like the flavor, but anyway. So if I'm baking for other than my own personal consumption, you want to be careful not to get, because you can do some dental damage with the. Getting the hull into the cooking.
Yeah, aren't squirrels just something else? They've got their...
Last year, I started with a part of a cast iron plumbing fitting and a hammer. And it worked. but it shattered the nuts so much that you couldn't
pick the pieces out.
It was hard.
It's an art form, I do believe.
It is. And it's a wonderful thing to just spend your time with in the
wintertime.
I have some information here before we get to a short break about nutrition. The nutrition of black walnuts, and all nuts are really good for you. Black walnut kernels are 5% water, 59% fat, 24% protein, and 10% carbohydrates. They're good for you.
And the fats in them are really good for you.
Yeah.
The premier walnut processor, industrial scale, is down in just near Kansas City in Missouri. It's called Hammond Walnuts.
And that's for black walnuts.
They do pecans also.
Oh.
And, but they're black walnut, but they pay for black walnuts. People ship them. People collect them. There's a buyer in Boone, Iowa who buys black walnuts. You don't get much for them. I mean, you might get $100 for a pickup load.
Right. Because it's still a lot of work once you get the nuts, right?
That's right. But this is the only place in the country that processes them, and it
on a commercial scale.
On a scale, and they also take the hulls and powder them and turn them into an industrial abrasive. They have a certain quality.
That's right, because they're hard.
They have a certain quality that's really useful in some applications.
I have to say, my cat litter is made out of walnut hulls. Probably not black walnut hulls, but walnut hulls.
Well, special cat there. Well, I want to mention that this is KHOI Community Radio, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. ¶¶
back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Joe Lynch today about some of the stuff he does with local nuts. Yes, there's quite some characters in our area here, but we've been talking black walnuts and butternuts, hickory nuts, acorns, but also all this other stuff falls from trees, and we had an awful good apple harvest. Joe mentioned earlier that our Empire apple tree that we planted, oh, heaven knows how long ago, it just did a really good job this year. We had a fine harvest, and, well, I put up some for pie, and we've been eating them, and we did some.
Oh, they're really good eating apples.
They're just great. They're just, and we don't do much of those tree at all.
Do they bake well, too?
Yes, yes, yes.
They keep their shape, and I would imagine, yep.
Yeah. They're very good.
Oh, boy.
They're very good. But we had an apple pressing on our farm, and true to form, we don't do things kind of the usual way. You know, when we think about small-scale apple cider presses, a lot of people have these nice antique wooden turn the handle press, and you can find them in antique stores or your grandpa's back lot, you may find them. But the idea is you pick the apples, you let them rest a while to really get sweet. Then you,
like 2 weeks or something.
Yeah,
they have to cure a little bit.
Then you have to cut up those apples and mash them. And then put them, not only is cut them up and mash them, but put them in some sort of bag and press them to get the cider out. And usually, like I said, there was a lot of old-fashioned, lovely, antique ways to do that with a wooden a thing that you would turn, and then you'd turn the press with a crank on top. But leave it to Joe Lynch to come up with an interesting way to press our apple. Joe,
I have no idea. I do not remember where I found this idea.
Joe is an engineer,
but it's really spectacular how well it works, and it's easy to implement. And
I want to say that it's really wonderful if from year to year you remember where all the parts are.
Well, we hadn't done it since 2 years before the pandemic, so I had to dig all that stuff up, and I wasn't sure. But the first thing to know
is... It's a group enterprise also.
This technique that you can do in your own backyard requires two things that most people know about. One is a garbage disposal,
a clean
garbage disposal. It turns out that it produces twice as much cider as the old cider presses did, because the old cider presses didn't grind the apples up very fine, and so you're throwing away a lot of cider. This way, you set up a garbage disposal and an old sink that you can hang it from, throw the quarter of the apples and toss them into the garbage disposal, and they come out the bottom beautifully ground up.
Let me describe what this says. So we put a long table out, and Lana and I are sitting there on two sides of it, cutting the apples. You got to cut out all the bad parts. You can leave in the peels.
And the seeds.
The seeds, even the stems, the whole thing. But you just got to cut out the rotten parts. And then you got to cut them small enough to fit into the garbage disposal. So next to the long table where Lana and I are chopping away at these apples is an old double sink, underneath of which is hanging down the garbage disposal unit. So here we are, chopping the apples into quarters, throwing them into the sink, and then Joe puts underneath the garbage disposal,
if he remembers.
Yeah. a net bag in a bucket that catches all the pieces.
Right. And all the juice.
Yeah, we did run a few, and we forgot to put the bag under, so that was lost to the yellow jackets, I'm afraid.
Yeah.
But then he takes the bag of ground apples, soggy
mess,
yeah, and tell him what you do with it next.
Well, you tie it up, tie a string around the top of it, and squish the bag as close as you can to things, and put the bag in this cider press. Well, the press is a frame about 4 feet square made of 2x6s. And it has a plate at the bottom, just on the bottom part of the 2x6 frame, to put a pan that has a hole drilled in it.
Yeah, it's like an old dish pan, a plastic thing.
But it's pretty big.
Yeah.
And you
set one hole in the corner.
Right. You set a net bag of apple mush on the bottom of this pan, set a piece of flat wood on top of it, about a foot square, another wafer of net bag.
Right, we
another,
can do two bags of mushed apples at a time.
I've done three in the past, but it's they slip around really hard to keep them in the same place. And then you set what every rural homeowner has in his garage, a hydraulic jack on top of it. And and you jack...
Blocked up with extra pieces of wood.
Jack against the top of the frame, and it just squishes the juice out. Just clever as hell.
And then the juice goes into this pan on the bottom, the plastic pan, with a hole in the corner, and then the juice runs out into a bucket, and there you have it.
That's it. So it has one downside, yellow jackets.
Oh, boy.
And the cider pressing matches yellow jacket season perfectly.
Oh, they were, those yellow jackets were so exciting. I have to brag that I was, I shouldn't brag because next year I'll get it. I was the only one that didn't get a sting. I rolled my sleeves down and.
Next time I'm going to wear latex
gloves.
I think it might
happen. Joe got a lot of stings. They were like, I was sitting in the cut and chop position, and they were like, they were always getting on the knife and getting, you know, I just kept...
They're everywhere. So many
of them.
And I've often wanted to, well, I can still do this. I want to combine our crabapple sauce with some Empire sauce. And
juice, you mean?
And, well, sauce, no.
Oh, you want to make crabapple Empire sauce.
Then you could make apple butter. With
yes.
that combination.
Yeah. Oh, that would be good.
And I'll bet it's going to be really good.
Well, just taking the apple butter. Well, okay, here's how you make apple butter, right? You make apple sauce.
Right.
By just boiling down the apples. And I don't even add any water. I don't add anything to it. I just kind of let them steam in their own juice. And then I run them through that. My mom used to call it a ricer. It's an old conical thing with a wooden mallet, and it keeps the seeds and the skins, and just the applesauce comes through. Then if you want apple butter, you just put it in a crock pot and let it slow, cooks the water out till it gets thick and thick and
the
thick.
The forager chef says he uses just an open baking pan, throws it in a low oven.
You could. You could, but you'd probably have to watch it a little bit.
You do have to watch it and stir it.
The beauty of the crock pot is I have, knock wood, never burned any.
Right, exactly.
That's good.
Yeah.
That's good. Also, I've done that. I should do it this year because we have so many apples.
Yeah.
Also, some recipes call for whatever sweetening you like, you know.
Little, I don't put any sweetening in mine either.
Also, a little tad of either balsamic vinegar or another kind of vinegar if you want a little zing to it, like a little bit of brown sugar and vinegar or a little bit of maple syrup and vinegar.
Cinnamon is very common, too.
And cinnamon. Anyway, there are other things you can put in it, but thank goodness for the crock pot. What a good idea.
Yep, that works really, really well.
Just quickly mention the other mass that I remember this time of year is honey locust pods.
Oh,
now we humans don't eat them, but the sheep and the cattle love them.
Oh, do you collect them for your sheep?
I do, and save them for a wintertime feed. They really love
dessert
them.
For the sheep.
The other thing that I don't know who eats them, but they're a close relative to the honey locust is the Kentucky coffee tree. I found,
and this is also it's related to carob, right?
Yeah.
Which is also called St. John's bread. Mm-hmm. It has biblical references.
The Kentucky coffee tree, there's one or two on our property, but there's two gigantic ones in Brookside Park that show their pods usually in the fall, and they hang on till spring.
I bet the deer come and eat them.
I don't know who eats them for sure. I think the squirrels may eat them, but I don't know of anybody else for sure that
Well, if the sheep
eats them.
Eat them, it might be deer food too.
But the seeds, the pods are completely different. They're much shorter and fatter, and the seeds are huge. The seeds are as big as the end of my finger.
Well, it's like in carob, the seeds are not the edible part. which is also like a tamarind. In a tamarind, it's the pulp that's inside the pod around the seeds.
Well, that's what the cattle are eating.
The
If you taste it, it's sweet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's why they eat it, you know.
Well, and you didn't mention, after you press the apple juice and you've got this disc of apple bits.
Right.
You took it to the chickens,
that's
right?
That's right. You bet.
Or or if you have a horse, the horse would love you forever, or the sheep like it too. Yep. But yes, there's that leftover bit that at the end.
Every little part is used.
Every little bit is used. And it goes fast, too. I want to, I don't know if you remember, Joe, but the apple, the bags, the pressing bags that we got, you got them. You went online and you went?
I found them on eBay.
eBay. Bags for pressing apple cider. Already sewn up into a little bag shape.
Maybe they might be entitled jelly bags for all I know.
Yeah, they're jelly. Anyway.
But I found some jelly bags?
Yeah. But I found some really good quality ones that were much
that
better.
I
tried making them myself and that didn't work very well.
Yeah. You could just buy cheesecloth or mesh or whatever and kind of make your own. But some nice person already did this. And these bags have a little bit of elastic around
the top.
Oh, are we just
so they very sophisticated.
Yeah, they stay in the bucket really well with that elastic. Yeah.
Anyway, we ended up with cider. Now, Donna, what's the difference between pasteurized, hard, soft cider? This is not hard cider.
No,
yet.
It's referred to as soft cider because it has not fermented yet. Although, are you going to hold some aside and try fermenting it?
Well, it's pretty risky if you're not willing to go through all the procedures that are required to sanitize everything.
The Empire is not really a hard cider apple.
Right.
You know, if you happen to have a odd tree on your property and it's an apple tree and it doesn't taste particularly good, it's probably a cider apple, mm-hmm. which means it would make really, really good cider. The Empire is really an eating apple. Right now in the grocery stores, you have either Wilson's cider or Diehl's cider. Those are two big apple growing families in Iowa that make really good cider. Both of them also do sell hard cider, but you know, you'll find at all the grocery stores now, the gallon jugs of cider. And by law in Iowa, it has to be pasteurized. I think Diehl's makes filtered or unfiltered. I always just buy the least processed, so I try I don't notice that there's much difference between the two, but the stuff that we made is actually, of course, raw, so it's for our own private consumption. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to make a guess on this one, but the difference, you know, when you buy cider like that, and it's usually really, we can only buy it certain times of year appropriately, right? The difference between that and the apple juice that you usually buy, the apple juice must be much more highly filtered. You know, it's always lighter in color. It's always
pasteurized, cooked.
Yeah, well, they're both pasteurized, but I suppose maybe it's more ultra pasteurized. I don't know what the difference is, but it looks different and it tastes different.
It tastes very different.
Yeah.
What else can you do with apple cider? The maple syrup thing.
Aha.
You can boil it down.
Oh,
and it is delicious.
Oh, boiling
I've
it
only
down
done it once.
Until it's like a syrup, yeah.
I've only done it once, but it's amazing.
It's a real old-time sweetener. You know, we forget there were many hundreds of years when sugar was not available. And besides maple syrup, people used sorghum and boiled apples down.
Honey,
of course.
Right.
And also, a lot of apples were originally used to make alcohol. In the early pioneer days, that was a big, because you can store it, you know. I mean, the apple season is, I mean, it's longer than some fruit seasons, but the time of year that you can store those apples and the apple juice.
But 150 years ago, that's what people drank was cider.
Hard cider. Yeah, fermented, yeah.
And the person that knew how to blend to get the flavor they want, the different varieties, he was hot stuff.
Yeah.
Okay.
So we'll just drink the stuff that we just pressed.
And
it's
even
good.
In certain, like in France, they make something called Calvados, which is actually an apple brandy. So it's a distilled apple juice. Really, really yummy. We probably have some tradition like that in this country,
too. Oh, I'm sure.
Some kind of hooch. I don't know. Joe, maybe we should... There must be a legal way to set up a still if you're not selling anything, right?
Oh, if you're not selling it, you still distill whatever you want. It's not illegal. It's illegal to sell it.
Yeah.
Not to make it.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Dear. Now we suddenly have another project for the winter. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, yeah. Maybe Joe can jerry-rig us a still.
Ooh, something with a hydraulic jack, perhaps.
We know somebody in town that already knows how to do it.
Oh, good. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. Okay. Well, there are lots of things you can do with these apple juices. Okay.
Good, good. I want to mention this is KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen. You can find out more at khoifm.org. And I want to mention that we didn't get around to talking too much about chestnuts yet, but Donalana Kitchen in our archives and as a Donalana Kitchen podcast has a show called Chestnuts with Luke Gran, which is a lovely thing. If you are into chestnuts, look that up. Go to khoifm.org or find us as a podcast. Welcome back. This is the Donalana Kitchen. Homemade cider, picking nuts all winter long. I guess we have a pretty good life here in Iowa. Yes, if you want to take food from trees, that's good. Donna, do you have a few things to say about chestnuts? That's a good
thing. Oh, I love chestnuts. I love, love, love chestnuts. So chestnuts are, you know, there are a lot of chestnuts in Europe, but there also was a, you know, American chestnut, you know. What's that Longfellow poem? Beneath the budding chestnut tree, the village smithy stands, da-da-da-da-da-da. It's a very iconic tree, which sometime within the early part of my lifetime, we had a chestnut blight. And we lost a lot of chestnuts. We used to have so many chestnuts, and it was
one.
Do
you remember
them? I don't remember when it happened. Do you remember when it happened?
Well, I think it was earlier. I think it was like 1910, 1920.
Are times in my life, like I for a while lived in Pennsylvania, and on that property there was a big chestnut tree.
They didn't kill 100% of them. It killed
a lot of them. It really knocked it back. Yeah.
Right.
So in the ensuing time, which would make almost a century, it has given time for plant breeders to breed in a resistance to that virus that killed the trees.
Well, the resistance comes from a Chinese chestnut.
Chinese chestnut they bred it with. And at this point, we have begun to have enough of them grown out in Iowa that every year, this time of year, I managed to buy some. This year and last year, I bought some. You can go online. I think it's Valley Chestnuts or something. Mm-hmm. In eastern Iowa, they actually are growing more and more chestnut trees, and they have invested in a chestnut sorter because chestnuts are sold by size. I, of course, like the big ones, that are at least an inch or more. Although they taste the same no matter what, but, you know, being a greedy chestnut eater, the bigger
ones
are easier.
I know where there are two chestnut trees that bear in Ames, Iowa, but I am not telling under pain of death.
Sorry, you all folks, you'll have to order from Valley Chestnut.
Yes. Also, there are some chestnut trees on campus if you happen to know is someone on campus that knows where they are. However,
keep
your eyes peeled.
It's like finding the pawpaw trees on campus.
That's
too
true.
They're dropping fruit right now as well. So anyway, with the chestnuts, I mean, you know, my favorite turkey stuffing is wild rice with chestnuts in it and lots of, you know, herbs and sage and stuff like that. But for just eating, and I'm very excited because I've put my order in and they might be in my mailbox when I get home. I don't know. But you just, you know, you store them in the refrigerator because they will eventually dry out and get kind of hard. And they also can get moldy, but more likely they dry out and get hard. So you store them in the refrigerator. And I like to do this for dessert after dinner. I'll take, like, you know, maybe 6 or 8 per person. And you must crack them. Like, I just take a knife, like a fat chopping knife, and sink it into each one. I don't go all the way through the nut. But if you don't make some kind of slice in it, some people like to put X's. I just put a chop across it. They will explode in the oven. And then you have a mess, right? But as long as you crack the shell somewhat and then put them in the oven, I just take a cast iron skillet and, you know, crack each nut individually, put it into the pan, and then stick it in the oven. And depending on the size of the nut, I'd say 10 minutes or so. You know, how I do it is I take one out and I open it up, and if it's still, when they're not baked, they're a little more rubbery, but by the time it sort of crumbles and sweetens up, then you know it's ready. Then you can take the whole pan out and you can just put it on a little wooden board on the table, and everybody splits their chestnuts open and eats them right out of the shell.
You can make a chestnut cream too.
Oh.
Bake the chestnuts and then put them in a pan with some milk and soften them up a lot
more.
Boil
them in the milk or cream.
Then mix in some chocolate.
You can get fancy with these.
That's right.
I have to say,
yeah, everybody likes
chocolate. The first time I had ever really had chestnuts, this was in a small Greek restaurant somewhere in Manhattan, you know, 50 years ago. They had, I don't know what kind of machine they had, but they put the chestnuts in and it ground them into like little, like long...
Really?
You know, it was, didn't put anything in it. It wasn't sweetened or anything. And then they served it with whipped cream and some apricot puree. And I was sold. That was it for me and chestnuts. Oh, my goodness. So you can do a lot of things with chestnuts. You can make chestnut puddings.
Right.
You can, a chestnut bread pudding would be really good because they're a little bit sweet. Like in France, and you can buy these in lots of online markets, there's a company that makes... They cook them in a sugar syrup, and they also make a paste out of it. So you can buy them already processed.
I've heard there's a Christmas street food in Switzerland that has meringue with chestnut cream on top. And
oh,
chocolate.
Well, and in France, they boil them in sugar, and they're sold as candies, whole chestnut. They're called marron, which is the French word for chestnut, marron glacé. So it's like just a candied chestnut, sort of the way we do, you know how you have those candied cherries and chocolate at Christmas and stuff like that?
And specialty stores, you can buy canned chestnuts.
Even
paste chestnut. You can buy... What was the other way that dried? You gave me a bag of dried chestnuts.
Yes.
That you turn into flour.
You can buy chestnut flour. I would store it in the freezer once I got some, and I was so delighted. And by the time I used it, it was rancid and it just tasted terrible.
Yeah, right.
But you can bake with it.
Right.
In the local Asian store, we'll have to go look. Last year they had in little foil bags, already peeled chestnuts that I found were really quite good for using in baked things or even for putting in the stuffing for the turkey.
They were raw?
No, lightly steamed and peeled.
Ready to use.
You know, you didn't exactly want to just eat them out of the bag, but if you're using them for cooking, and I found those at our local, what's that mini, the Asian mini mart on...
Well, there's a Korean one on Lincoln Way.
That's where I found it.
And there's one next to Hy-Vee West.
No, well, I don't know that one. Yeah. The one on Lincoln Way. So you can buy a lot of chestnut products.
Good. We're celebrating trees today. Trees. And here's a little bit about how trees grow from this book, Hidden Life of Trees, by Peter Wollenben. And he has a chapter here called Social Security. It basically breaks down to the fact that you know, we think, well, that chestnut tree's growing over there, and there's some on campus, and we have to keep track of where things are. But trees actually are happiest when they are part of an ecosystem called a forest, because they all help each other. We're learning more and more about how information and food and chemicals are shared in the fungi, in the soil.
Underneath the tree, there's a lot going on.
They're doing lots of things that we don't know. And you'd think that, oh, you're helping a tree out by kind of clearing up around it, but Not so. They really do need one another. Apparently, trees synchronize their performance so they are all equally successful. That's okay. And when you try to manage a forest, what you're doing, you're managing for some bored feet there and everything, but all in all, the forest does not do so well, because in a healthy forest, whoever has an abundance of sugar hands over some to the others. Who's ever running short gets help. Fungi are pushing this back and forth and back and forth. And so trees working together. When trees grow together, nutrients and water can be optimally divided so that each tree can grow into its best tree. And if you help individual trees by getting rid of their competition, the remaining trees are bereft. And everybody's kind of wondering what goes on, because when there's a blank space in the forest, trees are meant to live next to each other. And when there's space, there's all kinds of stuff that can happen in there. And it's good to have the weaker members and the stronger members all working together. The community grows best when the crown is thick for everyone and when the roots are all busy and connected. This Hidden Life of Trees talks about research of beech trees, because that was kind of their standard tree they were talking about. But they realized that there's a lot going on in the roots. There's a lot going on in the forest. A chain is only as strong as its weakest link. Trees could have come up with this old craftsperson saying, and because of that, they know this intuitively. They do not hesitate to help one another out. So that's a bit about the social security of how forests work, and I'm glad they do. We've been talking about nuts. Local nuts.
We just went nuts today.
And because we were talking about local nuts, we've had Joe Lynch here to talk about.
We also talked about fruit, too.
And fruit.
We picked local fruit from 11 different things this year.
On your property, yeah.
Not all on our property.
It has been a good
fruity year
for all of that stuff. So, apples and we did share some with the Yellow Jackets, so that was interesting. I got a number of stings on my hand because I peeled a bunch of apples yesterday for pies, and yes, the bees or the wasps showed up. Well, you've been listening to the Donalena Kitchen. We've had music by the Barn Owl Band. Support this fine radio station. And go to www.khoifm.org to find out more about community radio. And also, there's a silent quilt auction there that goes to November 5th.
If you need a silent quilt, that's the place to go.
It's a wonderful silent quilt. So go check that out on the website. My name is Lana Nachtigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.